You're listening to the 1632 Atari Podcast. Episode 6. The One with the Chipset. Overview.
Hello, and welcome back to 1632 Atari Podcast. I am your host, Wade, and this is part 6 of my adventure into rediscovering the Atari ST computer. The dates covered in this episode are 1987 from April through June. There will be no computer covered in this episode. However, the chipset will be covered and the SH204 hard drive.
Do not lie. By the time you got to recording, you forgot again and included the STM1 mouse instead. Clearly, you need better note organization. Your computer has features that can assist with it. You should check them out. News.
Well, I've been using ST Basic quite a bit. In fact, I wrote a program that's an RS-232 file server, and it just has two simple functions, which is send and receive file. I wrote this so that it uses Xmodem with the basic checksum. It doesn't use CRC because it was going to get too complex in computing in ST Basic. So I went with the easy route, and I only want to transfer one file anyway. So all this, like I said, was just to transfer a real communication software to it, or one file. And to top it off, I use my Atari 130XE with the ICD-PR connection on the other end with the null modem cable in between. Yep, I spent an evening with the multimeter testing pinouts of DB25 and DB9 cables that I put in boxes some 20 years ago, just so I could figure out what their functions were. In retrospect, labeling them would have been a pretty good idea. Now that I spent considerable amount of time with ST Basic, probably more than I ever did in the 1980s, I can say that this software stinks. The edit window has major issues if your program is longer than the window. If you scroll down and you can't see the last lines, no matter what, there's no way to ever see them, no matter how you scroll it. Then it's missing some basic file I/O functions or the language itself. You can reference files sequentially or by record. And that sounds good, but it's difficult to write to sequential file without dumping a carriage return into it. So if you use it in record mode, you have record number and size limits as well. I can go on and on.
Please do not. I think they understand.
So the software program that I want to transfer over is Antix Flash 1.6 for the ST. So I transfer this over to ATR images, which are the disk image format for the 8-bit, and then to real Atari 8-bit disks. I had to put them on real 8-bit disks because the SIO to PC or USB adapter doesn't work with the PR connection in line. So with the PR connection modem handler loaded, it would interfere. So real disks it is. And once I get flash over, I won't need this ST Basic version of this file server. Oh, and by the way, don't download Flash 1.1, at least the image that is on Atari Mania or was on Atari Mania. It has a porn image in it, a file named B. So if you do download it, don't open file named B. I did tell them, and so maybe it's fixed now, and I also sent them Flash 1.6. So with my software written, I tried to use it. On the 8-bit side, I used Amodem 7.5. And with all the cables tested and no combination that I had would yield a null modem cable with the correct male-female connectors for the ST and the ICD-PR connection. So I used the cable I built in the early 90s to transfer between my Atari 8-bit and the Atari 8-bit interface on the PC.
He means between the Atari 8-bit with an 850 interface and the PC.
When I was testing, I was receiving characters, though not always the right ones, but sending nothing back. And after several rounds of troubleshooting, trying different RS-232 settings, nothing worked. I couldn't figure out what was going on. So I opened up the cable ends and found on one side that two wires had broken free. And then I looked at the pinout, and it's a pseudo-null cable, not built to full null spec. And it's kind of funny because it worked back then and I haven't touched this cable. So maybe if it's not wrecked, it would work now. I don't know. So I got the soldering iron out and tried to restore it. In the meantime, I found a null DB9 male to female adapter that's the same size as a gender bender. It's very, very small. I ordered this from Amazon and there's a link to this little guy in the show notes. After receiving the null modem adapter, I put it in line. Set the ST port to match the 8-bit port settings at a whopping 1200 baud, and I discovered my program wasn't working right. The receive routine was receiving the characters, but not processing them correctly, and it wasn't sending characters correctly. So while tracking it down, I found I was using VAL in place of ASC in the ST basic code, but that wasn't the whole crux of the problem. So, scratching my head, I went back to tracing the pinouts from the ST to the 8-bit. I found the problem to be with my straight serial cable. It can't be straight. The 8-bit PR connection mimics the Atari 850 interface, and Atari used an Apple-based female DE9 serial port connection. It's wired slightly different than what the PCs used when they came out and what the entire industry adopted at that point. The Atari port is configured for transmit on pin 3, which correctly maps to pin 3 receive data on a standard RS-232 DB25. That part was working. Pin 2 on a standard RS-232 DB25 should transmit data, which would map to pin 2 normally, but on the Atari 850 interface, pin 2 is carrier detect and pin 4 is receive data. So again, I'm not sure how this cable ever worked, but I know that it did because I used it. In fact, on Atari Age, I posted the source code for Procom that I wrote, which was a little server in the Procom software. So back to building a custom cable. So I cut one end off of my cable. I desoldered all the connections and created a correct mapping on paper from the ST through the DB25 to DB9 converter down to the 9-pin connection on the PR side. Then I soldered it back how it should be. Then I realized I did it for the male side instead of the female side of the cable. At this point, I decided to throw money at the problem and I ordered an Atari CX88 null modem cable for the 850 interface, which is exactly what I need.
Truth be told, his close-up vision is not what it used to be. He was struggling to see and generally making a mess of things.
It hasn't arrived yet, and rather than delay, I went ahead and started doing this episode, so I'll finish that up in the next episode. I also played with Atari's CPM emulator under ST emulation, but I hit a wall when trying to actually run a CPM program from the CPM shell. It will only read disks formatted in CPM format, which Atari supplied a utility for, and another utility to transfer files from TOS disk to CPM disks. However, I couldn't get a CPM disk formatted properly under the emulator. This is why I wanted software to transfer files over to the ST so I can run something under CPM on real hardware. Did I mention how difficult it was to track this software down? I haven't forgotten that I need to send working images of it to you, Pete, so hang on, as soon as I get them, I will send them. All right, last I want to mention that I'm very impressed with how quiet my 4160 STE is. I can't hear it when it's on. Even the floppy drive is whisper quiet, which I didn't expect. The only thing I can really hear is the track change. It's kind of like using my MacBook Air, except when the fan kicks on. There's not too many whisper quiet computers anymore. Nice job, Atari.
New releases.
Well, the big news here is that in April of 1987, TOS 1.02 is released. Time to upgrade. So another notable release that I thought was interesting was the MS-DOS emulator, but it's MS-DOZ, and it uses 448K or 960K of the ST's memory. It runs at half the speed of a PC and uses an extra 32K. It can run 70% faster in a comparable mode. This is mostly compatible so long as software doesn't access the hardware directly. Looks pretty interesting if you want to run MS-DOS titles on your ST. Another thing I thought was interesting is that Abacus Software has renamed DataTrieve to DataRetrieve. That seems kind of silly. The first name was, I think, better. I also saw that Prospero has released Pro Pascal and Pro Fortran 77. And I have now seen the first ad for FastBasic, which shows it has a speech synthesizer. I talked about this the last time and didn't know that was a feature. It contrasts itself with GFA Basic, which does not have the speech synthesizer. In the Start magazine that I review later, it has a full-page ad for Mark Williams C. I had this version of C when I had my ST. I did my college C homework with it, and then I would take the printouts to school and type them in on a Macintosh. It wasn't too long after completing the C course that I sold the ST, though, and I'm not sure if this is new at this point, but it's newish, and it makes me think that I may have had the ST longer than what I had originally thought before, so I might be pushing 2 years with the ST. So maybe I got rid of it in mid-88. The price was $179.95, and today that's $393.17 for a C compiler. I recall not liking the Micro Emacs editor that was included, and I really still don't like Micro Emacs. I think that anybody that uses a Unix-type operating system probably uses VI at this point. And now the funny thing is that C compilers are free. I also saw that Alpha Systems is selling a cart called the Watch Cart, and it has an RTC. This is advertised as the cheapest one at only $24.95, which is $54.51 today, and it includes a 3-year battery. And the last bit of news I want to mention is Terrific Corp, the makers of the EasyRAM 520 and the ZTime, now have a product called Gateway, and this is a 23-channel programmable I/O device that's in cartridge form. You can control lab equipment and different things like that. It includes software to control Radio Shack's Armatron. Remember Armatron? I had one of these, and I always wanted to write something for the 8-bit to control it. Well, with the ST, I guess I could have. And in fact, it mentions it comes with software to do that. So this seems kind of like what everybody's doing with the Raspberry Pis and Arduinos now.
Hardware.
The hardware is going to be a little light in this episode. The next one will have another computer, in fact, two computers. So in this one, I will include the system specs, the chipset combination of commercial and custom chips. And when I'm talking about these, all these chips are present unless I note otherwise. For the ST, STF, STM, and STFM models, they all have the Motorola 68000 chip. With this is the CPU. It runs at 8 MHz. It has a 16-bit data bus and 32-bit internal bus with 24-bit addressing. There's the Yamaha YM2149F SSG chip. An SSG is a software-controlled sound generator. It has 3 tones and 1 noise channel. It produces square waves, and it wasn't specifically designed for the ST, and it's a pseudo-clone of the General Instruments AY38910 chip. Next is the Motorola MC6850P ACIA. This is the Asynchronous Common Interface Adapter. This enables the ST to directly communicate with MIDI devices and the keyboard. It's actually 2 chips, one for MIDI that runs at 31.25 kbits per second, and one for the keyboard, which runs at 7812.5 bits per second. Next is the Motorola MC68901 MFP. This is the multifunction peripheral chip. It's used for interrupt generation and control, serial and miscellaneous control signals. The TT computer has 2 of these. Then there is the Western Digital WD1772PH. This is the floppy disk controller. Next is the Hitachi HD6301V1, and this is a keyboard processor. This processes the mouse and keyboard ports. Now we're on to the custom chips. So the first of which is the ST shifter. This is the video shift register. It enables bitmap graphics using 32K of memory for all the resolutions. The screen addressed has to be a multiple of 256. The next is the ST glue. This is the generalized logic unit, and this is a control logic for the system used to connect the ST's chips all together. It's not part of the data path, and it's needed to bridge all these chips. There's the STMMU, which is the memory management unit, and this provides signals needed for the CPU, BLITTR, and DMA, and the shifter to access RAM. Even memory access cycles are given to the CPU, BLITTR, and DMA, while the odd cycles are reserved for RAM refresh, or they're used by the shifter for displaying frame buffer contents. Then there's the STDMA. This is the direct memory access. This is used for floppy and hard drive data transfers. Now the next three chips are specific to the STE, the first of which is the BLITTR. This copies, fills, or clears large blocks of memory, and it's capable of processing 4 megabytes per second. Next is the ST Enhanced DMA sound chip. This is two-channel stereo 8-bit PCM sound at 6.25, 12.5, 25, 50 kilohertz. And last is the National LMC1992. This is an audio controller. This allows left, right, and master volume, bass, and treble adjustments. Because I'm short on hardware for this episode, I'm going to include the STM1 mouse. This was a rollerball mouse, and it was approximately 100 DPI. There were 5 to 7 versions of this mouse produced. Some had plastic rollers, others had brass and chrome rollers. Most of these were made in Taiwan, and they included a 9-pin D-sub connector. The pinout is pin 1 is up, or XB, pin 2 is down for XA, pin 3 is left for YA, pin 4 is right, or YB, 5 there's no connection, 6 is the left button, 7 is positive 5 volts, 8 is ground, and 9 is the right button. Right now I have a Logitech MX Master Mouse. It's capable of approximately 1600 DPI and works on virtually any surface, and it has 7 buttons, though the most I use on it are 3. But what I like best is that its tail is clipped. But it's interesting to note that how much the resolution has changed on mice over the years.
Magazines.
Okay, let's start here with magazines. With all the magazines, I'm not going to report on reader comments unless there is something superb in them. I started this practice midway through the research on this episode, so there may be some, but there will not be any in the next ones. Of note this time, ST user is no longer an insert. And with that, let's start with ST user number 14, which is from April of 1987. It's volume 2-2. It's 68 pages cover to cover, and it has a size increase in pages, so I'm no longer going to count how many are content and how many are ads. Okay, on the cover of this one, instead of it being gray in the past like it has been, it's all white. In the upper left-hand corner, it has Atari ST user, kind of diagonal. The Atari and user words are yellow and much smaller than the ST letters, which are red. Those are all superimposed on 2 of the gray-silver stripes that you had previously seen on the entire cover.
He is referring to the color.
It notes as the official Atari ST magazine. There's a picture of a 1040 ST and an Apple Macintosh on the desk, and it says how to make your Atari ST think it's a Macintosh. Oh, so hey, guess what? I forgot to record the rest of this issue, so here it goes. But there's a little bit of noise in the background. I hope it's okay. So this issue has a new format. It's much more professional looking, and it's a whole lot easier to look at. There's an advertisement in here for the Atari Computer Show coming on April 24th through the 26th. There's going to be arcade games, bargain offers, and much, much more. This is going to be at the Novotel Champagne Suite in Hammersmith, London, And the tickets will cost you £2. So I will see you there. Oh, and Jack will be there with over 70 exhibitors as well. The first feature is the show report, and this is called From Tramiel with Regret. And this is Jack's introduction of the Atari PC to ST user. And this is titled Regret because they feel that the PC is inferior to the ST. So the Atari PC is going to run at 8 megahertz. It's going to have EGA graphics, an XT detachable keyboard, and a pizza box style case. And of note, Atari is now debt-free and has $70 million in the bank and is in a much better position than Commodore ever was. Atari 1986 sales ended in $258,131,000, up from 1985 with $141,987,000, which is an 81% increase. There's a total profit of $25 million here. And in the previous year, they had a net loss of $14 million, so a big difference. Oh, also, they talk about the Mega Drive is coming in the summer, and the new Atari Mega STs are also previewed. For the Mega STs, there's a picture, and it has a pizza box style case as well with a detachable keyboard and includes either 2 or 4 megabytes of memory. There's a game review in here for Adventure Games, Leather Goddesses of Phobos by Infocom, and Scott Adams' Spider-Man. And in there is a review of the RobTech McEmulator. And this is a box that turns an ST into a Mac, and this was reviewed by Andrew Ralston. So just like the Magic Sack, you have to source the Apple ROMs from somewhere else. And of note, the software will run about 20% faster than on the Mac. And the Atari has a higher resolution monitor, and most apps can make use of that higher resolution. There's a feature in here called Opening Up Gem for the Programmer. This is by Ray Jackson, and this is a Gem programming primer in C. Then there are a couple of reviews, the first of which is for Epson LX86 printer. This is by Ian Byfield. And one of the notable things in this review is that Epson has a 45% chunk of the home user market. I never realized it was such a large share. The next review is mainly for software, and this is Epic's Championship Wrestling by Bob Chappell. Then there's Pyramid's Wanderer by Bob again, which is a space shoot 'em up that uses 3D effects and makes you wear 3D glasses. There's also a review for Skybox from Ariolasoft and Electronic Arts. This was reviewed by Douglas Wooler. Then there's Alternate Reality, The City by Datasoft, reviewed by Dennis McKnight. This version of Alternate Reality looks more colorful than the 8-bit version, and I guess I would expect that, but I was hoping the graphic screens would use more of the ST's real estate rather than being confined into the small subsection of it. There's also a review for CAD 3D by Tom Hudson. This was done by Kev Bulmer. And he used this CAD 3D software to design the Europa House, Database's new HQ. Database Software, they are the publishers of Atari User and Atari ST User. And one of the notable things with CAD 3D, he says that you can only have 20 objects and you have to use joins to overcome that obstacle. The only bad part is that joins take a long time, approximately 20 minutes. But it does have full features, and you can view wireframes, shaded, or rendered pictures. And he asked for Tom to produce CAD Elite to fill the shortcomings that were found in CAD 3D. There's also a review in here for Battery-Backed Timekeeping by William Gray. And this is a MicroDeal clock card. It fits underneath the keyboard, though. So it sits underneath the keyboard chip, in fact. And this says it'll run up to a week without power. And it uses 2 rechargeable AA's, which are charged when the ST is turned on. When I first read this, I thought it might initially be a good option for me, but my ST can sit off for weeks at a time. Next, there's a feature called In Search of a Character. This is by Richard Phillips. And this is a desk accessory that shows the character set. And when you click on a character, it shows the decimal and hex values for it. And this is written in C language. The next feature is called Design Your Own Printer Driver, and this is by Andrew Ralston, and this is a print driver creator for First Word and First Word Plus. And there's one more review in here, and this is called String Along with the Alternative by Microdeal, and this is done by Chris Quickett. So the software they're talking about is called Alternative, and this is a macro recorder which can store strings up to 60 characters on up to 36 key combinations. And the last feature in here is the letters to the editor, and I'm not going to cover those. The next ST user is number 15. This is from May of 1987. It's volume 2 of 3, and it is missing. I could not locate it, so I can't report on it. The last ST user for this episode is number 16, and this is from June of 1987, and this is volume 2-4. Again, this one is missing, so I couldn't report on it. And now we'll move on to the ST logs. First, I have a correction from the last episode. And in the last episode, I said that the ST logs were number 4, 5, and 6, when actually they were numbers 10, 11, and 12. That's what I get for copying and pasting show notes from a previous episode instead of using the template. Also of note, January 1987 marked the switch from inclusion in analog to a standalone magazine. Okay, the first ST log is number 13. This is from April of 1987. This is volume 2-1. This one is 84 pages cover to cover. On the cover of this ST log is a picture of an office space or a desk space. Actually, the office space is on the left and the desk space is on the right. Basically looking at two different pictures kind of merged into one. On the left-hand side is kind of contemporary. On the right-hand side is kind of homey feeling. And if you look at it, there's a modem on the left with a telephone, as well as GFA Basic and IS Talk and the Star Glider game. And on the right, you have the disk drive. There's a clock and an overhead lamp and the mouse. Up in the top, you have the ST log with the chrome-looking logo. And at the bottom, it has what's included in the magazine, and this is a telecommunications issue. All right, the first feature in here is called Status Report. This is by D.F. Scott. And in this one, he talks all about Atari's PCs, and there's also talk about a blue chip PC compatibles at the Atari and Commodore price points. And I guess these blue chip PCs were made by Hyundai. I had no idea. So this talks a lot about Atari's foray into the PC market, and specifically that it was a response aimed to give dealers DOS-compatible low-cost alternatives. There was a marketing snafu initially saying that they had 8086 CPUs, which have 16-bit data bus, but really the Atari PCs only had 8088/2 CPUs, which only have an 8-bit data bus. The next feature is called Ma Bell 2. This is by D.F. Scott, and this is a tale about the start of the phone system's demise. There's a history lesson about digital video and BBSs, and little did we know that in another 30 years, most people won't even have a landline. The next feature is called Life on the Citadel, and this is by Steve Yelvington. This discusses the Citadel BBS, which was implemented on an Atari ST with public domain software. This was not a BBS in the conventional sense. There were no menus, just rooms that you could join. The next is a feature application called Escher Cubes by James Luczek. And this is an isometric drawing program written in ST Basic. And it's long. The next feature is called A Bawdy Tale, B-A-U-D-Y. And this is a beginner's guide to telecom. And this is by Maurice Molyneux, or at 8-bit underbar Maurice on Twitter. This is a good overview. It even had me relearning the difference between baud and bits per second, and not just the acronym. For a long time, I thought baud actually stood for bits of actual usable data, but that's not what it's actually stands for. Baud is termed from the French engineer Emile Baudot, who invented the 5-bit teletype code. Baud measures signal events when there are changes in bit value. And in this article, Maurice advises you to stay away from 300 BPS modems. I wonder why. And he gives a good explanation of some of the things you can do with the modem as well. The next feature is called Step 1, and this is Part 3 for New Users by Maurice Molyneux. And in here, he talks about basic GEM usage and file management. There's also a handy keyboard shortcut cheat sheet included. The next section is called Review ST, and this reviews several different pieces of software: Base BBS, GFA Basic, Magic Sack, Interlink ST, and the Sierra's Quest series. Then there's a feature called Telecommunication Roundup. And I'm not really sure this is a feature so much as a feature summary of available COM programs. But then there is a feature called ARC Shell 2, and this is by Charles F. Johnson. And this is a GEM interface to the TOS ARC program. There's a basic listing which creates the machine language code. And there are a lot of hex in here. So if you enjoy typing in hex, this is for you. The next feature is called Ian's Quest. This is by Ian Chadwick. In here, he discusses editing and word processors. He notes that he prefers PerfectWriter for CPM on his K-Pro 4. This featurette is not one that I'm really coming to like all that much. It's mostly opinion, and in fact, it states that on the title page for the articles. But it's not really one that I really am excited to read every month. The next feature is called Seamanship, and this is by Clayton Walnum. This dives into dialog boxes in C, and he discusses the object trees behind them and includes a Visio type flowchart, which I'm sure was fun to create without Visio. And he also talks about the widgets that you can use as well. The last feature in this one is called ST User, and this is by Arthur Leyenberger. And this is largely a review of Personal Letter Writer from Montyware. This software, after you create your masterpiece letter, you let it insert random spelling mistakes, alter words for misuse, like the words two, T-W-O, and two, T-O-O-O.
Two, T-W-O, O's, not three, T-H-R-E, E.
That and who and have and got. The idea is to make the computer printout look like it's more personal. So I'm thinking, why not just not use a spell check in the first place? And the last one is an ad, which normally I don't talk about ads, but there have been a few of note in this episode. This one is from Sierra, and it says, "Everybody loved radio until ... television came along." Video killed the radio star. Video killed the radio star. Pictures came and broke your heart. And in this one, they tout that they're pushing the 3D graphic animated adventure games. I would argue that they are 2D, but whatever. The next issue of ST Log is number 14, and this is from May of 1987. This is volume 2-2. This one is 88 pages cover to cover. And the cover of this one is light green or teal. At the top, it has the Chrome logo, but it's kind of yellowish in this one. And on the cover, it has some sheet music superimposed with a piano, if you're looking down from the top of it, with the Atari Fuji logo on it as the lid. And there's a person playing the piano. There's also a small Polaroid inset on there of a musician standing in front of the ST with some keyboards on a rack. Presumably he's making some music.
Maybe it is Factor 6, and he is composing Give Me Time.
And there's a description on the far right that shows what is inside the issue, and this is the music issue. The first feature in this one is called Ultimate MIDI Dream Machine by Malcolm Cecil. And at this point, MIDI is 4 years old. He gives a good overview of what it is and what you can do with it. And one thing to note is Malcolm has a long list of credentials, including building world's first and largest polyphonic synthesizer, well, still the largest at the time of writing, and it was called Tonto, the original new timbral orchestra, which was in the process of being MIDIized. He also worked with numerous bands, including Stevie Wonder, Joan Baez, and the Jackson 5, and he worked on the original Star Trek movie score. Next is a review, and this is of the Casio CZ-101 and the Casio DX-100 keyboards. I had a small Casio keyboard before I had my ST, but nothing like the units that were reviewed here. Mine was more of a toy. I don't even know if it had MIDI ports on it, to be honest with you. The software MIDI Play is also reviewed in here, as well as SDI by Mindscape, an interactive fiction game, and Flash's Antic, which is great timing for me because that's one of the software pieces that I'm trying to pull over to my STE. The next feature is called Professional Musicians and the Atari ST, and this is by Frank Foster. He's the president of Hybrid Arts, or was. And this is the story about how the ST rose above Commodore, IBM, and Apple in the music studio. And he gives info on how several artists used the ST, including Peter Gabriel, the Pointer Sisters, and Tangerine Dream, to name a few. The next feature is called ST News, and this is just a new product section. Then we move on to another primary feature. This one is called Education, and it's Music Steps and Triads. And this one is by someone named Regina, who is a regular columnist for Compute, and she is the author of Elementary ST Basic, but there is no last name. So this is a program to help you learn the keyboard, and it's written in ST Basic. This reminded me a lot of Atari Music 1 and 2 for the Atari 8-bits. I featured those, or that, in Inverse Atascii, Season 2, Episode 15, and there's a link in the show notes for that if you're interested. The next feature is called CZ-101 Patch Librarian. This is by Kirk Stover. This was written in ST Basic. The listing is very long, but has hundreds of lines that contain data statements with a couple of pages worth that are all zero, so at least they can be entered easily or replicated. The next feature in this magazine is called ST Clock by John Brochu. Hope I pronounced that correctly. This is a digital clock desk accessory. It's more than just a clock, though. It also sets some common control panel settings for you. Next up, we have the feature Ian's Quest by Ian Chadwick, and this is largely a review of Mindscape's Balance of Power, where you play the leader of the USA or USSR. The next feature is called Step 1 by Maurice Molyneux, and this is the fourth installment of the Beginner's Computer User column. This is all about desktop customization. He even gets into editing the desktop.inf file by hand. The next feature is called Entertainment Desktop Napoleon, and this is by Bill Kunkel, Joyce Worley, and Arnie Katz. This is reviews of ST combat simulations, GATO from Spectrum Holobyte, High Roller from Mindscape, and Ogre from Origin Systems. Ogre's one that I've been seeing a little bit about, and I'm really intrigued to play because it has an 8-bit version as well, so I think I want to play both of them and see how they compare. The next feature is called Seamanship, and this is by Clayton Walnum. This is the second part of building dialogue boxes in C, continued from the previous issue. Next up is Catching the ST Sound Wave by Charles Johnson. This is an overview of MIDI software. Then we have another feature called Database Delphi by Matthew Ratcliffe, and this is a review of discussions from Atari Users Group SIG on the Delphi service. I think I may omit this one in future episodes because I just don't find this been very interesting at all.
Mouse click deleted here.
The next feature is called Preview, Making of ST Talk Professional by D.F. Scott. And this is a preview of version 2 of the ST Talk Professional software. The next feature is called Challenge Met. And this is the announcement of the winners for the ST Log Programming Contest. First place was Floyd the Droid on the Run by Paul Lay. This was worth $5,000. Second place was the ST Font Printer by Charles Johnson. This is worth $2,500. And third place was C-Mail by Peter Nichols, and this was worth $1,000. I think the Yellow Pages would have a copyright issue with one of the images in this. He used the Walking Fingertips logo that they made famous. There's also three honorable mentions here, worth $500 each. The first is Picture Puzzle by Guy Davis, the next is Con by Colin Fowler, and the next is Flag Trivia by Mike Rupertus. Each of the programs here are going to be featured in upcoming issues. The next feature is called A Different Kind of Computer Game, and this is by D.F. Scott. And this is a story about Batteries Included sale to Electronic Arts, the events that led up to it, and the awful transition. This talks about new products being dropped as well. And the last feature in this one is called Assembly Line, and this is by Douglas Weir. And this is more or less the day in the life of a 68,000 CPU. He goes into how instructions for these life activities are formed and cites examples for understanding. There's a lot of attention to addressing the registers and hex notation. I have to say that I didn't really care about reading this one. I am pretty much middied out at this point due to so much coverage. Although it's ranged for almost 2 years, I have consumed it in less than one. So there's too much of it right now, and most of it has been intro stuff. The next ST log is number 15. This is from June of 1987, and it's volume 2-3. This one is 88 pages cover to cover, and the cover may be one of my favorite ones yet. This one is all black background. It has a man in front of a computer sitting on the desk, right? And he has his head laying down on the keyboard with one hand on it as well, and there's smoke coming out of the back of his head. On the screen is a single bomb, which it's hard to make out exactly what it says on it, but it says something. Error at line, blah, blah, blah. But it's like 10 million or something like that. So his brain is obviously cooked from how many lines of code he's created. With 10 million lines, maybe he's been working on the first version of Windows. Who knows? Anyway, on the desk, he has several crumped up pieces of paper. There's a programming the 68,000 book. There's a calculator. A mug that's in the shape of a face, and it's full of pens, and he's got the spaceship from Lost in Space, I think it is, I'm not sure, maybe, on top of the monitor. Again, the ST logo is the chrome-looking one, and other than that, there's nothing to note on the cover, other than it's this special programming issue. The first feature in here is called Language Overview. This lists all the languages, which products are available for them, and the price point for each one. The next feature is a utility, and it's called Printer Font by Richard J. Bourne.
Like the Identity, Legacy, and Ultimatum?
No, but it's spelled the same way. This is a font designer and loader for the Epson, Star, and Panasonic printers, specifically for those printers that could download character sets and print with them. This is written in ST Basic. The next feature is a tutorial. This is called Animation with Pascal, and it's by David Plotkin. This is actually multiples. It's OSS Personal Pascal programs to generate real-time animation of multicolor complex figures. So one is by Mark Rose of OSS, which is the API calls into GEMS raster functions, which you compile into an object and then link into the other programs. Going to kind of lump all the reviews in together, and to start off with, there's Shanghai by Activision, Karate Kid 2 by Mictron, World Karate Championship by Data East, Golden Path by Firebird Software, Arctic Fox by EA, Alternate Reality The City by Datasoft. I want to play this one because I was a pretty big fan of the 8-bit version, and I'd like to contrast them. There's Golden Oldies by EA, which includes Adventure, Elisa, Life, and Pong. There's Publishing Partner by SoftLogic Corp. Encrypt by Stone Age Software. Dollars and Cents by Star Monogram. I thought this one was still kicking around in some form. I could have sworn I saw this in 2016 when I was looking for a Quicken replacement. It does say that there was also a PC version, so it's quite possible it might still be out there. The next feature is called ST News, and the big news here is a preview of the Atari SLM 804 laser printer. It's supposed to have 300 by 300 DPI and print at 8 pages per minute with a 3,000 page toner and a 10,000 page drum at the measly sum of $1,500 tentatively.
That is $3,276.33 today.
Last year, I replaced my DeskJet printer with a laser printer. I ended up getting a Brother HL5200DN.
HLL5200DN.
And this printer is capable of 1200 by 1200 DPI and has 256 megabytes of onboard memory. It supports PCL6, IBM ProPrinter, Epson FX, PDF, and XPS printing types. And the one thing I wanted to mention was the drum. The drum is capable of 30,000 images, which is quite a difference between this Atari one. And the toners you could get in either 3,000 or 8,000 page form. See, I computed a total run cost on a per page basis to be at 0.017 cents per page when using the 8,000 page toner and 0.026 cents per page when using the 3,000 page toner. I guess it's noteworthy to mention that since I installed it last year, I think it was around June timeframe, I've basically done nothing to it. I've not had to replace any cartridges, nothing, just putting paper in it. Which is a thankful thing because the inkjet printer I had before, it seems like every time I replaced one ink cartridge, I was told that I needed to replace another one. So I was constantly putting ink in it. The next feature is called Seamanship by Clayton Walnum, and this edition covers menu bars. And the next is one of my least favorite. This is called Ian's Quest by Ian Chadwick. And this is opinion and story about educational software for the ST. I really liked his mapping the Atari book, but for some of these Ian's Quest, they are really loathsome to read. And this is one of them. It's probably because I despise reading or hearing heavily opinionated verbiage. The next feature is called ST Label Maker, and this is by Charles Johnson. And this is a gem-based mailing list and label maker. Then we have Assembly Line by Douglas Weir, and this is more on addressing and the stack. Then there's a feature called Status Report by D.F. Scott. And in here, he's talking about chasing the missing blitter chip. This might be the biggest embarrassment for Atari since the 1450 XLD. Man, I wanted one of those. The next feature is ST User by Arthur Leyenberger, and this is talk of switch boxes for sharing peripherals and a mini overview of the Black Box Corporation. I think I mentioned before that they are actually still around. The next feature is called Step 1. This is by Maurice Molyneux, and this is the fifth installment of a series for beginner users. And this one, it's all about disks. Floppy disks, hard disks, RAM disk, disk gumbo, chicken disk, you name it. Looks like there's going to be a sixth column too. By the way, Maurice's mini bio indicates that he is allergic to all things Commodore and has never been bitten by an apple. He also got an 800XL for animation work before he upgraded to the ST when it came out. It also states that he was working on a sci-fi novel, which I searched for and I couldn't find any published novel. So Maurice, if you're listening, let me know if you published it. You can reach me with @InverseAtasky on Twitter. The next feature is called Database Delphi. This is by Matthew Ratcliffe, and this is more from the Delphi group. And like I said for the last one, I think I'm going to omit these in the future. Next up is GFA Basics, a feature by Ian Chadwick. And this is a how-to for GFA's new BASIC. This first column gives an overview of the language. And the last feature for this issue is by Frank Cohen, and this is an overview of the Atari scene in West Germany. Okay, Start Magazine number 5. This is summer of 1987, volume 2-1. This is 124 pages cover to cover. And on the cover is a picture of a swimming pool in a backyard, and there's a girl on an inflatable raft laying in the middle of the pool, catching some rays. Poolside, there's a table with an Atari SC1224 monitor and it looks like a 1040 ST and a pair of red sunglasses. The word start is in great big white letters at the top and it says the ST Quarterly. On the right hand side in the top corners has the disc inside with the prices. Along the left hand side, it has the features inside. First up in this magazine is the editorial. And they asked the question, what had over 1,700 pages, 2 million bytes of software from the finest ST writers, Tom Hudson, David Small, Dan Moore, Matt Lovelace, Patrick Bass, and others, and cost only $60.
I do not know. What?
The answer is a subscription to the first year of Start, the ST Quarterly, which included Antic, the most successful Atari magazine of all time. Circulation numbers for Start have grown 25,000 year over year to over 50,000 in the last year. It mentions that Antic includes the magazine and magazine, the ST resource. I thought Start had grown from that, but maybe I'm misunderstanding something. So apparently they're still going side by side. They are asking for more subscribers and for more advertising so they can leave the quarterly status behind. And that's just what everybody wants, right? More advertising? Now, normally I don't mention ads, but I think this one needs to be. There's an ad for Aegis Animator ST. And in this ad, there's a picture of a 1040 ST on a desk with a SC1224 monitor. There's an analog clock behind the ST, a small yellow canary sitting on the monitor, and a model of a military jet next to the monitor. Presumably, the monitor is depicting an image from the animator software, and there is a military jet on the display. But...
Uh-oh.
Yep. It's a different plane. Completely. Nice job. The first feature in this magazine is one called Flickr. This is by Jim Kent, and this is animator software. And it looks like someone beat Yahoo to the name. Okay, so it's spelled differently, but still, you get the point. This lets you combine up to 128 images into an animation if you have 4 megabytes of memory. Otherwise, an unmodified 520 will allow you to animate up to 8 images, and the software is on the disk. The next feature is one called Super Toolkit for Degas Elite. This is by Patrick Bass, and this is a feature that talks about building a desk accessory utilizing GEM message pipes to extend Degas's features. There's an 8-page image flipper presented, and the software is on disk as well as presented in the magazine. The next feature is one called The Astronomer, and this is by Inek A. Kalinko Jr. I hope I pronounced that right. And this is a star map. So it's not highly graphical, but it does plot points for stars and marks planets with the letters. However, they're not proportionally sized in the view. So it's kind of a rudimentary astronomer, and it's on disk as well. There's also a review in here for SoftLogic Publishing Partner. This is by Charles Johnson. This publishing partner is similar to Aldus PageMaker on the Mac. It looks pretty decent. And I had used PageMaker previously on the PC after my Atari days were over. So I know a little bit about desktop publishing. And I think that SoftLogic Publishing Partner is worth looking at. The next feature is one called Plumbing Gems Mysteries. And this is by Tom Hudson. And this is more about building the Degas Elite desk accessory using the GEM pipes. This article gets deep into the technical on how it works. Then it presents an info grabber for Degas Elite. This made me remember something from back in the 90s when I wrote some Windows programs that intercepted and fed messages from the Windows piping. And I have to mention this ad as well. This was one for MIDI Maze. Kill a Happy Face, and this is by Xanth. Now, the first time I played this was at the VCF Southeast 3 a couple of years ago, but it was on the 8-bit side against Brad, Randy, and Kevin from the Antic podcast, and I was pretty good, actually, and they didn't think that I had played it before.
Be careful. You are going to break your arm patting yourself on the back.
And it was actually quite fun. The software is only $39.95, and today that's $87.29. I guess on the ST that would not include a MIDI adapter, whereas to play it on the 8-bit, you need the little SIO to MIDI adapter. The next feature is the Musical ST. This is by Jim Pearson Perry, and this talks about MIDI software, players, sequencers, and librarians. The music player programs are kind of like a jukebox. I doubt this will ever catch on. No one will ever want to listen to a playlisted music on their computers. I just don't see it happening. The next feature is called Pack Text, and this is by Daniel Matejka. And this is text compression and Huffman coding using Personal Pascal. This is a GEM-based program. The article has a great intro to information theory and also gives a general overview of the ASCII character set. So there are 95 unique characters, 26 upper, 26 lower, space, 10 digits, and 32 punctuation and symbols. With 95 uniques, it requires at least 7 bits to encode. My favorite quote in the article is, "The whole idea behind ASCII was to invent 95 different bit patterns, assign some meaning to each, and attempt to make the whole thing appear as if it were conceived by a guiding intelligence," end quote. This article also features a good overview of Huffman coding. The next feature is TimeWorks Powerful Business Trio, and this is by Matt Lovelace. And this is an in-depth look at WordWriter ST, Data Manager ST, and SwiftCalc ST. I've been waiting for this one. These packages have looked very professional and appealing. These use the diff format to interchange information between products. I've talked about the diff format on Inverse Itasci several times, specifically when dealing with the Synapse software trios like SynTrend, SynCalc, etc. And when reading this, it seems that SwiftCalc ST doesn't measure up to the same quality as the other two and doesn't reflect in its name, Swift. On the plus side, TimeWorks said if you can find a competing product that works better for you, they'll buy it for you. And that's for all three of these. So I think I'll be checking these out soon. The next feature is one called MidiSave, and this is by Tom Bajoris. And this is a Casio and Yamaha patch librarian for saving synthesizer data. There's another feature in here called Escape the Desktop, and this is by Jeffrey R. Wilson. And these are IBM-type commands for your ST. It's a CLI desk accessory with 58 unique commands that require 33K of memory, and only 10K when it's not in use. And the article starts off by defining what a CLI is, command line interface. I think anybody reading this would understand what a CLI is, since this GUI thing is all relatively new. There's another review in here called Five Basics for the ST by David Plotkin, and this features Atari ST Basic, SoftWorks Basic, Logical Design Works Compiler, Computer Concepts Fast ST Basic, and Mictron GFA Basic. This has a complete analysis and benchmarks of each. And the one thing it doesn't do is offer a clear recommendation. And that's one of the things I despise about reviews when they're comparing multiple products together. I hate it when the reviewer leaves you to decide which one is best. And the last part of this is called the catalog, and this is the Antic software catalog. Okay, Computes Atari ST number 4, which is April of 1987. This one was 68 pages cover to cover. And I'm not going to describe the cover on Compute as I didn't last time because they're just not interesting. The first feature in this is one called ST Programming Contest Winners. And the winner was Laser Chess by Mike Dupong. And this was worth $5,000. So you can think about this as chess with lasers. And timely as it may be, there's a review in here for GFA Basic by Mictron. And this was done by George Miller. There's also a review of WordWriter ST by TimeWorks, by David Plotkin, and DAC Easy Accounting by DAC Software, reviewed by Thomas M. Castle. The next feature in this is called Directory Dump by Marco Zarola. This creates printouts of disk directories. The next feature is one called Desktop Notepad by Tim Victor, and this is a desk accessory notepad. Then there's another feature called Customizing the Gem Desktop by Mackendra Haynes. And this is how to modify the desktop.inf file, specifically what all the bytes in the file mean. The next feature is one called Programming in C, and this is the C programming environment. This was done by Sheldon Lehman. This is another beginner's intro to C programming. I think this is the same guy that wrote InstEdit for the Atari 8-bit and authored Mapping the Commodore 64 book.
It is.
Check out Antic Podcast interview number 266 to hear more from Sheldon. There's a link in the show notes. The next feature is one called Sprite Maker by Mark Swanson, and this allows editing multicolor shapes for simulating sprites. And there's a feature called File Finder by Richard Smareka, and this solves a problem I didn't know needed solving back then, which is finding every occurrence of a file on a disk. Think the Unix find command, but not as powerful. Then there's a section called New Products and News, and there's more information about the Atari CPM emulator. There's also a section in here called The Ear, which is all rumors. And then they have the picture of the issue, and in this one it's the water hole. And this is a small shrub-shrouded mountain pond with trees reflecting in the water and a lightly clouded sky in the background. This was drawn by Rita Plux. Now, Compute would have a second issue that I would review in this episode, and that would be Compute's Atari ST number 5 from June of 1987. However, it's missing. I couldn't find a copy of it anywhere, so I can't say anything about it. Next is Atari Explorer, spring of 1987. This one is 84 pages cover to cover. And the one thing I didn't realize is that these were quite this big. I thought the Atari Explorer was relatively short, like 20 pages or so. On the cover of Atari Explorer is a Mega ST4 sitting on a bluish purple desk, or maybe there's just some color discoloration in the cover here, with an SM124 monitor sitting on top. At the top of the image, it has the Atari Explorer logo, and all around in the free space, it lists what is inside the magazine. So the one thing about Atari Explorer that I noticed is that it's full of reviews, the first of which is VIP Professional, reviewed by David All. There's one for Neochrome by John J. Anderson. There's one for First Word 1.06 by Betsy Staples. There's one for Label Master by MyGraph, done by David All. And Label Maker and Mailing List Manager together, they can incorporate graphics on the labels, which is a neat touch. There's a review for Financial Cookbook by EA, done by Andy Eddy. There's a review of Golden Oldies by EA, by David All. And this has Adventure, Eliza, Life, and Pong. And then there's a review of Dollars and Cents by Monogram Software, this one reviewed by David All. This is Quicken before Quicken. And if I were doing a retro challenge and only to use the ST, I think this would fit the checkbook bill. There's a review of GFA Basic by John J. Anderson as well. This was the first BASIC to make a case for programming in BASIC on the ST. This produces code similar to C in execution speed from structured source, and there's no line numbers. There are a bunch of game reviews in here, Sly Fox by EA, World Games and Super Cycle by Epix, Wanderer by Eldersoft, and there's also one for Ogre by Origin Systems that says it's available for the ST in the 8-bit, and this is a two-player strategy game, but it makes no mention of being able to play via modem. That's too bad, and it would be awesome if you could, and maybe you still can. I want to look at that.
Mouse click deleted here.
And there's another review in here. Remember those Stereotech 3D glasses I picked last episode? Well, they're reviewed here. If you're interested in speed, they can display 1 megabyte of graphics per second at 60 frames per second, which is 2.5 times faster than a movie. But it doesn't give an overall rating of the product, though. In addition to all the reviews, there are a few features, the first of which is Impressions of the Mega Machines, and this is by John Janeshig. And this is a review of the Mega 1, 2, and 4. And I thought the Mega 1 never shipped, but anyway, they talk about it, and I think this is early in the announcement time for the Megas, so maybe it's planned but never ships. The next feature is Palindromes by David All, and this is an interesting basic program that supports both 8-bit and the ST. The next feature is called Intro to Gem VDI, and this is part 3 by Bob Cockcroft, and this looks at polymarkers, alpha markers, graphic text, and writing mode. The next feature is called Teletalk by John J. Anderson, and this talks about ARC compression, and it uses an example of Atari CPM distribution being available in the ARC format on CompuServe. So it was free, and it was out there. I had been looking for this, and I finally tracked it down. So now what do I do with it? Also, this article discusses Delphi and Genie. And the last feature in here is called SoundChip. This is by Paul Swanson and John Janeshig again. And this is digging deep into the MIDI protocol.
Picks.
My hardware pick this episode, and I've seen this advertised quite a bit, and I've started to grow to like it. And this is going to be the Digital Vision Computerize. This device plugs into the cartridge port and captures full-color images in under 6 seconds from any standard video source, such as videotape or camera, using a standard video or RCA jack. You can fully control the color, grayscale, or monochrome, and it works with most software too, like Degas, Neochrome, and others. It does require power from a 9-volt source, though. The cost was $249.95, which is $546.12 today. Now, that seems kind of expensive. I have a similar device to this for my Mac, but it's USB-based, and it can also grab super video images and capture movies. Technology has advanced quite a bit, and I only paid about $35 for that video capture device on the Mac. My software pick is going to be GFA Basic. And a little bit about GFA Basic. GFA is a company that was started in Germany. The author of this Basic was Frank Ostrowski, and he wanted to develop an entirely new Basic, not just an improvement on the ST Basic. He wanted structured programming similar to Pascal and Modula 2, and he wanted it easily understood and retain Basic's flexibility. They partnered with Mictron in the US for the English version. The interpreter uses 55K of memory, and ST Basic uses about 150K, so it's quite a bit smaller. Included in GFA Basic are a lot of the Microsoft Basic commands. It does require a runtime, which is in the public domain, to run the programs. One nice feature is that the editor has instant syntax checking. You can, however, write with any editor and import it so it can be saved in tokenized form. In addition to for next, it also has while and wind, do loops, repeat untils. So you get all kinds of looping constructs. It allows for labeled go tos and go subs. It also has procedures. But one odd bit is that you can only have one command per line. No statements separated by colons like every other Basic I've worked with. But one nice feature over ST Basic is that indents can be used. So when you run a GFA Basic program, the speeds are very close to that of C, but slightly slower. And the cost was $79.95, which equates to $174.68 today. And the best feature of all, it's better than Atari ST Basic, at least based on everything I've read.
Application.
So I learned several things this episode, the first of which is that Atari ST Basic stinks. Seriously, don't waste any time with it if you're new to the platform. One of the most useful things I learned is that you can manipulate files in inactive windows by holding down the right mouse button and interacting with the left mouse button, kind of like dragging to the trash. It's a neat trick. And while this isn't directly related to the ST itself, I read in one of the ads that Regent Word automatically reformats the entire document as you make changes.
Just like modern word processors. Neat.
Exactly. No more pressing a key or key combination to reformat a paragraph after modification. The start article on compression got me interested in the coding algorithm. I've always taken compression software for granted without worrying too much about how it's compressed, just as long as it did a good job. I use Zip and 7-Zip almost exclusively now, but Arc, Zip, LHA, Zoo, etc., all those in the past. Maybe the rest haven't survived as well, I really don't know. But while reading it, I became interested in how it works. The article in Start focused on Huffman coding. And at the conclusion, I wanted to read more, so I thought I would share with you what I learned. We'll start at Huffman coding. So Huffman codes use the smallest number of bits practical for commonly occurring characters and necessarily more bits for the less common ones. This is loosely based around frequency distribution of letters that are in the usage. Thus, unevenly sized codes can be stuck together, disregarding simple matters of convenience like bit boundaries. So here's how this came about. It started with a field of science known as information theory. This field began in 1940 after Claude E. Shannon of Bell Technical Laboratories devised a set of theorems that showed, among other things, that many messages are redundant and that they contain more information than is actually needed. So when the redundant patterns are identified, they can be encoded more efficiently. Fast forward to 1951, David Huffman was at MIT. He and his classmates were given a choice of a term paper or a final exam by their professor, Robert M. Fano. With a term paper chosen, Robert assigned the topic to the problem of finding the most efficient binary code. David Huffman was unable to prove any codes were the most efficient. He was about to give up and start studying for the final exam instead when he thought about using a frequency-sorted binary tree, then quickly proved that this method to be the most efficient. In doing so, he outdid Professor Fano, who had previously worked with Claude Shannon to develop a similar code. By building the binary tree from the bottom up instead of the top down, David Huffman avoided the major flaw of suboptimal Shannon-Fano coding. Their code does not produce the lowest possible expected code word length, but theirs does guarantee that all code word lengths are within one bit of their theoretical ideal, which Huffman's code does not. So they each have pros and cons. The first trick is creating a code delineation table so that no code begins with a sequence of bits that is the same as a shorter code. For example, if E is the most common letter and thus owner of the shortest code, which could be 000, then no code for any other letter can begin with 000. This ensures unique character has a unique code. Longer codes can contain shorter sequences, though. In the example text of the article, with the space being the most common, it was encoded as 00. The next most common was E with 010, then T with 011, and U was 110011. The key to this is knowing where in the bitstream the encoding starts and that each code has a unique starting pattern. The next trick is to determine the optimum length for the shortest code and when to start using longer codes for less common characters. There is an outside possibility that the entire scheme actually produces a longer packed file if the more common characters are not common enough such that less common characters require more than the original 8 bits to represent. The increment in number of encoding bits has to be early enough to prevent pattern repetition, but late enough to prevent long average code lengths. So it turns out there's an algorithm for this. B equals negative log base 2 times P, where P is the normalized probability of the occurrence, and the result B is the number of bits required to encode the character. For example, say E makes up 17.9% of a file, then negative log 2 times 0.179 equals 2.5 bits. Rounding down would cause an overflow problem, so it's rounded up to 3 bits. A good Huffman code of a typical text containing only capital letters requires an average of 4 bits per character, which would pack the file by roughly 50%. You add in lowercase letters and punctuation, and the requirement jumps to 5 bits per character, which would pack the file by about 35%. So there are links to the Wikipedia entry and an excellent visual understanding at Brilliant Math and Science are both in the show notes. The latter website can sum up exactly how it builds the codes tables much better than I could, so I'll just refer you to that. In short, it builds the codes table from the bottom up, starting at the least used symbols. I didn't know about this Brilliant Math and Science site before, but it's quite remarkable. If you haven't ever experienced it, go and check it out. Also, in the Atari Explorer, there was an article that referenced ARC compression, so I read up on that as well. And while ARC does compress, its main goal is archiving. It also includes support for many different compression methods, including packed, squeezed, crunch, squashed, crush, distilled, and with the latter three implemented by Phil Katz, PK, versions of ARC and PAC. So I'm not going to dive down that rabbit hole, but I will tell you that Jason Scott produced a documentary on BBSs, and compression was featured in Part 8, and there's a link to that in the show notes. It's well worth seeing.
Demos.
Before we get started into the demos, I just want to say that I don't really like describing these, I found out. I think it's too hard to convey the imagery. So I probably will just start listing those that were released, noting any that I really like, and referring to the show notes for links where you can watch them yourself to get the full visual impact. I've included the links in the past anyway, so this seems like the best route to me. So with that said, here's this episode's list. There's the Little Sound demo by The Exceptions. This was released in April of 1987, and it plays a game music with a little scroller on it. There's another one called Little Color Demo by The Exceptions, which was released in May of 1987, a month later, and this plays several tunes and has several colorful scrollers on it. And the last one that I'm going to mention is Shiny Bubbles by Xanth FX. This was released in April of 87. And you remember the image I described from the ST log with the shiny balls reflecting the word Atari on the bottom and the red and white checkerboard reflected on the top? That was from this demo, or at least I think it was. But here it's fully animated with balls circling each other and the Atari words scrolling from front to rear. And all of this is done in an isometric point of view. Although there's no sound, but it's still very cool. You should at least check this one out if you don't check any of the others out.
Feedback.
I've received more positive feedback, and thanks for producing the episodes, and I'm glad that it's been enjoyable, so thank you for listening.
Do not forget to mention that both Inverse Ataski and 1632 have been picked up and are now prominent on the related Atari Reddit pages. Links are in the show notes.
To encourage more feedback or even user submissions, here's what will be in the next episode. The Atari 520 STFM, the Atari Mega 2 ST and Mega 4 ST, and the Atari SH-204 hard drive. The SH-204 is being included because it was missed previously. The time frame is for July 1987 through September of 1987. So if you have something you want to share via email, go ahead. Or if you want to post it on Facebook, that's fine. Or if you want to even submit an audio submission, go for that as well. I look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thanks.
Thanks.
I want to thank Pete for the use of the PR connection. It has proven itself useful. Even though I haven't actually connected the two computers together yet, I still plan on completing that project, and it will be useful. I will make sure of it. I also want to thank Factor 6 for the music used throughout. It's from a track called Generalist with ST in capitals.
Do not forget, Give Me Time, which is also his work.
There's a link to it and other music from Factor 6, not in the show notes, but on the website at 1632podcast.info. Please check out his other work. It's quite entertaining. And I want to thank the letter M, because without the M, we would only have EGAs instead of MEGAs. And last but not least, I want to thank you for continuing to listen and support me in this endeavor. Thanks, everyone.
Hey, will I get paid overtime for my contributions this time? Goodbye.